This is Mariana over here, transmitting live from Basel. Where the day feels a bit liquid, but also a bit sunshining. I think we are all feeling this transition from cold days in winter to springy feelings, where it's just easier to be outside. So welcome to this program, that it's specially thought for Lasse and Jonathan, who are in the fjord. But of course, everyone is welcome to stay with me and listen to it. I'm saying it's specially dedicated to them because it is continuation of a series of conversations and meetings we've been having over the radio as well for the past month or so about how it would be to host and run a school program over the radio, and also how we would like to create an archive or a resource library around it. And these conversations, we've been discussing around structures that might help us shape the program, about the temporality of it, about what is an archive, about what would we like to keep and store in the archive. What would we just give away in the liveness of the radio making? How would we perform this archive? And how we might use it as a platform for the school in general, I guess. So you can also listen back to these conversations. I guess they are available in our SoundCloud channel, the Sadie's Fjorder Community Radio channel. And yeah, so we are in this at this point where we agree that each of us is going to make a show for the others, where we can try to condense some like parts of these conversations and these ideas into maybe some practice or exercises around these sessions. So I'm first, and I have to say, I like last week when we agreed to this, I was a bit nervous, good nervous, thinking about what should I do for this program. I'm quite new on this kind of radio making thing, which I love, and I'm very hooked in it and very into learning and just practicing. So let's see how this goes today. But I was thinking a lot, what should I do and what should I bring, and like my first reaction to it, that it's maybe obvious, is that I went on looking for what is radio online, like very basic Wikipedia knowledge, to try to find also words or terms that that might help us shape some of these ideas. I mean, these are very technical terms on how radio works, but they're actually kind of beautiful terms that I think might also inform how to do it. So there's, for example, something like alternating current or carrier wave or temporal frequency or transmitter or antenna or conductor or remote sensing or transductor. I'm not going to describe these terms, not now, but I'm just gonna leave them float around, so they might land into something or become with us into something else. Then I realized that the whole kind of a structure of this, I mean, I don't know if it's a structure, but this program started unfolding before my eyes by doing what I was doing throughout the week. And that kind of routine, or just by paying attention to certain things that, I don't know, came up in different conversations or readings or situations, gave me some elements that I want to present you, and let's see, I'll take you on this ride with me. I'll just tell you what I did last week, and slowly we're gonna see how these events started to create something that might be a prototype or a simulation of what this school might be. Yeah. So, the first thing that happened, or that started like triggering the rest of the events, is that I went to the movies. That was last Wednesday, and then I went to the movies here in the like film theater of the city, and they were premiering a film by a Romanian director. His name is Radu Jude, and the name of the movie is called Don't Expect Too Much of the End of the World. Actually, this film, we have it with Lasse in our list for the movie club of Mondays. So I highly recommend it. But yeah, I watch it. I cheated a little bit. But I mean, because it was the premiere, they brought the director to have a conversation with a film critic before the movie was screened. And I just couldn't help it. I wanted to go. And they talked a lot. They talk about many things. But then he was talking about his own city and how it is like a very cinematic city, kind of because it's such a condensed place. There's a lot going on, and he was talking about how movies are unfolding and happening all the time in front of our eyes, in different situations that are given in the routine of the city. I don't think this is a very a new thought, but it was kind of special how he was telling this stuff. He was also telling us how he was never admitted into film school, and like how he trained himself by being the assistant of different producers and directors, from commercials to movies and TV shows. And then at some point on this line, he brought up John Cage, and he was saying how one day he realized that walking out the door and listening, he was actually listening one of John Cage's pieces. And yeah, I kind of liked this thought, and then I thought, yeah, I just need to listen more, and you know, like I also want to listen one of these pieces one of these days next to me. So that was that. Then I watched the movie. It's great. But that's the first part of this story that I want to tell you. Then next day I woke up early, had some breakfast, came to school for class, and then I thought I was just gonna spend the rest of the day at school in the library, maybe reading a bit, catching up. I have to write quite a lot these days, so yeah, I thought I would have like a working session, writing session at the library. And always like to start writing, I need to read something first to get in the mood. And then I had this short story that someone recommended to me some time ago, about a swimmer. It is a story by Anne Carson, and yeah, so I just picked it up from my list and went to read it. And then at some point in the story, the narrator brings up John Cage again, And but she brings John Cage in the context of mushrooms, and she's telling someone like how John Cage was also a mycologist and how he has a book on it and everything. And and how he founded the New York Mycological Society. So, like second time this week that I hear his name. And so I just kind of stopped reading and went to look if this book of mushrooms by John Cage was in the library. Then I didn't found the book, but then I found an article that was written in 2012, and it's called Mushroom Noises. And the article is telling how this New York Mycological Society, it's celebrating its 50th anniversary, and it also coincided with and how it also coincided with John Cage turning 100 years or something. So it was kind of a big celebration or a big event. And one of the central pieces of the event was a performance of a piece of John Cage that is called 49 Valses for the Five Boroughs for Performers or Listeners or Record Makers. So these 49th Valses was commissioned by the Rolling Stone magazine. And yeah, curious enough, it's a sound piece that by being commissioned by a magazine, it was published as a visual piece, not a sound piece. And the visual art was consisted of 49 multicolored triangles superimposed on a map of New York. And the triangles represented a score. And the score consisted in collecting random ambient sounds around these kind of locations that were marked by the triangles. And these recordings would compose then the 49 valses. Then this people at the society 50 years later decide to kind of recreate the piece by making the recordings where they were finding mushrooms around the city. And yeah, that's what they did. So this is the article about, and then I just saw it very clearly that there was a set of instructions for me to follow. But I am not an expert in mushrooms. And I wouldn't, I guess I would know where to start looking for mushrooms around here. But then I said, okay, I'm not gonna take the recordings from these sites, but I'm gonna take the recordings from the path that I go through when I go swimming every day in the river. I have some collections of these recordings, and I decided to make some new ones to then make my own piece of 49 waltzes. I'm gonna play this for you now. The recordings are a bit, are mixed and composed. A dear friend helped me with that. And yeah, I guess I'm gonna play this for you now, and then I can keep telling you what happened after. So, where is it? Alright, it's here.
Fasting man, huh? used to know if I could go to the beach till like the road and the almond pop.
Okay, that was 49 pulses. Following, just what was kind of presented to me, and now, actually, this whole thing came by reading this short story about a swimmer, and I kind of feel like I want to play it for you, because if we were all together in the room, I would just love to talk about this story with you. Yeah. So I am gonna present this story. It's called One Equals One, and I'm not gonna read it myself. It's read by, I think I'm sounding, yeah, maybe now it's better. It's read by a friend called Teju Ko. So I think it's not so long, but enjoy it.
One equals one. She visits others. Before they're up, dawn, she walks to the lake, listening to Bach, the first clavichord exercise, which she plans to have played at her funeral someday, has had this plan since she first heard the music, and, thinking of it, she weeps lightly. The lake is whipped by wind and tides, big lake, doing what tides do, she never knows, in or out. There is a man standing on shore, and a big dog swimming back to him with stick in mouth. This repeats. The dog does not tire. She peels a swim cap onto her head, goggles, enters the water, which is cold but not shocking. Swims. High waves in one direction. The dog is gone. Now she's alone. There is a pressure to swim well and to use this water correctly. People think swimming is carefree and effortless. A bath. In fact, it is full of anxieties. Every water has its own rules and offering. Misuse is hard to explain. Perhaps involved is that commonplace struggle to know beauty exactly, to put oneself right in its path, to be in the perfect place to hear the nightingale sing, see the groom kiss the bride, clock the comet. Every water has a right place to be, but that place is in motion. You have to keep finding it, keep having it find you. Your movement sinks into and out of it with each stroke. You can fill it with each stroke. What does that mean? Fail it. After a while, she climbs out over stones, puts on small flippers, re-enters the water. The difference is like the difference between glimpsing a beautiful thing and staring at it. Now she can scream into the way of the water and stay there. She stays. She is one of the most selfish people she has ever known. She thinks about this while swimming and after, on the beach, in her towel, shivering. It is an aspect of personality, hard to change. Generous gestures, when she attempts them, seem to swipe through the lives of others like a random bear paw, often making matters worse. And she finds no momentum in sharing, in benevolence, in charity. No interaction with another person ever brought her a bolt of pure aliveness, like entering the water on a still morning with the world empty in every direction to the sky. That first entry, crossing the border of consciousness into what? And then she searches for the right word, instruction of balancing along in the water, the 10,000 adjustments of vivid action, the staining together of mind and time, so that she is no longer miles and miles apart from her life, watching it differently unfold, but in it, as it. Not at all like meditation, an analogy often thoughtlessly adduced, but rather almost forensic, as an application of attention, while at the same time, to some degree, autonomic. These modes do not exclude each other, so swimming instructs. There is a stoniness. Water is as different from air as from stones, and you must find your way through its structures, its ancientness, the history of an entity without response to you, and yet complicit in your obstinate intrusion. You have no personhood there, and water is uninterested in itself. Stones don't care if you tell their story nicely. Your bowels, your miraculously lucky life, your love of your mother, your well-crafted similes, all are lost in the slide from depth to depth, pure, impure, compassionless. There is no renunciation in this, compare with meditation, no striving to detach. All these things, all the things you can name, being simply gone. Meaning, gone. Her visit ends. Back at home, the newspapers. Front page photos of a train car in Europe jammed floor to door with escaped victims of a war zone farther south, people denied transit. Filthy families and souls in despair pressed flat against one another in the grip to survive. Uncountable arms and legs, torn open eyes, locked in the train all night, waiting for dawn. A scene so much the antithesis of her own mourning, she cannot enter it. What sense it makes for these two mornings to exist side by side in the world where we live, should this be framed as a question, would not be answerable by philosophy or poetry, or finance, or by the shallows or the deeps of her own mind, she fears. Words like rationale become, well, laughable. Rationales have to do with composite things, migrants, swimmers, the selfish, the damned, the plural. But existence and sense belong to singularity. You can make sentences about a composite thing. You can't ask it to look back at you. Sentences are strategic. They let you off. She goes downstairs and out to the stoop, hoping it's cooler there. Traffic crashes past. Chandler on the sidewalk, making a chalk drawing. Comrade Chandler, she says. He doesn't look up. What's the drawing? He goes on chalking. His gaze is ahead and within. He lives in the back of the house somewhere. Speaks not much, draws a lot. She calls him comrade because she'd been reading Russian books the summer she met him, and she thought him secretive. This was an error. Secrecy implies a concern for one's own personality. You hardly ever see Chandler enter a room. He's just there. Or leave a room. He seeps away. Small tide of person, noticed as a retraction. She stands nearer. The drawing is a pear tree. She can see the pears all over it, small, perfect green chalk globes with yellow cream-white highlights. She wants to lean down and bite them. "You've hit the nail on the head here, comrade," she says. He doesn't answer. Once they had a conversation, extending over many months, in broken bits, about mushrooms. He'd said the thing he hated about being in prison was the mushrooms. For several days, she wondered if he meant the food, but it didn't make sense they served mushrooms in prison often enough to be a problem, or if he had a damp cell with fungus sprouting in the corners, but this, too, seemed extreme. And gradually she understood him to mean he had been able to see a patch of mushrooms, boletus, from his window, and he used to go hunting for those in the woods with his mother when he was a kid, and it made him sad. Not a mushroom fancier herself, she didn't have anything subjective to say at the time, so she told him John Cage was a mushroom hunter too, and wrote a book about it, a sort of mushroom guide, that she could lend him. Chandler didn't answer. She wasn't sure he read books or knew who John Cage was. Conversation is precarious. Now, as she looks at the very round, chalky, pale pears, mushrooms come to mind again, and she says, "One day, as I remember it, John Cage was out mushrooming with his mother." After an hour or so, she turns to him and says, "We can always go to the store and buy some real ones." Silence from Chandler. He's adding touches of red to the pear array here and there. Then suddenly, all his five teeth laugh. The laugh slams out of him and is gone. He returns to chalking. Quick enough," muttering to himself, and something she can't quite hear. Had a kit scan pretended, it sounds like. She returns to the stoop and stands on the bottom step. Evening now, still hot. "Long day, Chandler," she says to the back of his head. He's moving down the sidewalk to mark out a new drawing, red chalk in hand. It will be a fox. He likes a fox at the end of the day. Upstairs, she finds herself thinking again about the failure to swim. It can be quantitative as well as qualitative. Imagine how many pools, ponds, lakes, bays, streams, stretches of swimmable shore there are in the world right now, probably half of them empty of swimmers by reason of night or negligence. Empty, still, perfect. What a waste, what an extravagance. Why not make oneself accountable to that? Why not swim in all of them? One by one, or all at once, geographically or conceptually, putting aside gleaming Burt Lancaster, someone should be using all that water. Across the level ocean of her mind come floating certain refugees in a makeshift plastic boat, so crowded with passengers, they are stacked in layers and dropping over the sides. She has seen this picture. She has read that larger ships might sail very near, that they might stop to consider the woe and the odds, then keep going. Sometimes bottles of water or biscuits were tossed from the larger ships before they started their engines again. What could she put up against the desolation of that moment, watching the ship start its engines again? What is the price of desolation, and who pays? Some questions don't warrant a question mark. Passengers, to pass muster, to pass over, to be passed over, to pass the buck, to pass the butter, to pass out, to pass to one's reward. She's eating yogurt when the doorbell rings. "Didn't know that bell worked," she says, wiping her mouth with her sleeve as she gets to the door. Comrade Chandler doesn't answer. He gestures with his head toward the street. They descend. Yogurt on your eyebrow, he says over his shoulder as they go down. Oh, she says, thanks. The finished fox drawing is under a street lamp. It glows. He has used some sort of phosphorescent chalk, and the fox, swimming in a lucent blue-green jelly, has a look on its face of escaping all possible explanations. She stares at the blue-green. It has a clearness, wetness, coolness, the deep-lit self-immersedness of water. You made a lake, she says, turning to him. But he is gone. Now it is night, off to wherever he goes when he is absolved. She stands a while, watching the fox swim, looking back on the day. Its image is too strong, and yet the soul. How does it ever get peace in its mouth, close its mouth on peace while alive? To be alive is just this pouring in and out. Find, lose, demand, obsess, move head slightly closer. Try to swim without thinking how strong it looks. Try to do what you do without mockery of our heartbroken little error. To mock is easy. She feels a breeze on her forehead. Night wind. The fox is stroking splashlessly forward. The fox does not fail.
Okay, that was One Equals One by Ann Carson. And yeah, so that was the story I was reading and kind of triggered all these other finds and a score and a recording exercise and a composition for you to listen today. Yeah, and I don't know, I quite like the how everything happened in a way, because this was meant anyways to be part of my routine, and it just became this whole thing. And we've been talking a little bit about, for example, if we meet with this group of people that it's attending the school over the radio, like once every week, and then we have different formats for those gatherings. A score and listening sessions of the results of that score or workshop or instructions, and then maybe also having other material to listen to and to read together and to discuss. And how these sessions would be kind of guided by us, but at the same time guided by the participants and their contributions. And I just, going back to these thoughts of the film director and like just being able to pay enough attention to see kind of the highlights of a day that create a movie, but in this case would create a radio show and in the long term a school with others. I feel that from this story that we just listened, I could dive into it for a whole month, and there's just so many things to pull from and to translate into other things and to discuss in the light of our own present, and somehow the exercise of making this program today allowed myself to pay this kind of attention and translate it in a compressed form for you to keep feeding it and thinking about it. And also, like all these diversions of attention in the distraction of the reading, there's just so many kind of materials that start being almost an archive of this program itself. There are some readings, there are some images, there's a score, there's a sound piece that can be reused or transformed or interpret in other sessions, in other situations. I don't know. What else can I say? I'm almost reaching an hour, so I don't want to take a lot of time. But there are also some other things that are kind of in my mind about this, and it's also how do we refer or how do we relate with time over the radio. It's not only the time span that every program lasts, but also in which tempo or in which rhythm we come to it. Do we want to kind of come to it according to the regular calendar and time measuring that we use every day, or should we also kind of link that rhythm to other events that are also measuring time, but maybe in a different way, that it's not marked by the 24 hours or the 7 days a week or the 12 months a year. There are other cycles out there that are also helping us shaping time, but just focusing on other occurrences, such as the moon cycles or seasons or tides, and maybe the terms that I brought up earlier might also refer to this or not, who knows. But I think I'm gonna leave it here. I hope you enjoyed it as I did. It definitely kind of brought a different layer these days for me to think about this program. So I'll be looking forward to hear your response and hear from you. So yeah, that's it. I listen to you later. Bye.